Real Life, the program that talks about the life of real estate in the Hamptons and the North Fork. The people, the places, and the things that are the pulse and heartbeat of life on the East End. And now, Associate Broker of Sotheby's International Realty, your host, John Christopher.
Hi, this is John Christopher of Real Life, and today I have as my guest Mark Vysekis, building inspector at Southampton. Hi, Mark, how are you today?
Hey, John, how are you doing?
I'm doing great.
All right.
Listen, I want to ask you, tell us about your trajectory to becoming where you are today. How did you get there? I mean,
So it's kind of weird. A lot of people go through these, ping pong life-changing events. So the short story is I grew up in New Jersey. Born in Hoboken, lived in Newark, New Jersey, right after the riots. So these are formative years, right? Wound up going to college at Adelphi University, completed the degree. I met my wife.
In what, by the way?
In business.
Okay.
Yes. I was like most of the people that survived the 70s, trying to figure out what to do. And I wound up working for an insurance company, was not happy. Went back to school, and the long and the short of it is I wound up doing building inspection duties.
For whom?
For the village of Manor Haven. I had worked for an architectural firm in Queens.
Well, and, let me just interrupt for a second. So you got that job because of going back to school after having graduated from Adelphi?
Yeah, that's right.
So you went and took more courses in?
Yes, in architectural drafting.
Wow.
And I had formed my own business, expediting, and had partnerships with various design professionals, engineers, and architects. My experience in Queens and Nassau County was very intense, very learning the red tape of bureaucracy. And
it must be quite heavy there.
Heavy, like heavy, like heavy. But so
how do you get is it like how do you get through it? Is it like Russia by any chance?
worse
okay yeah. Or Italy, right?
Although,
Italy has,
you know,
a lot
there
of
been many attempts to streamline the procedures on various levels at various municipalities. And so here we are today. How did I get here? Through Manor Haven, Mineola, and Southampton. So I've about 30 years experience.
Wow.
I ran the building department in Manor Haven, which was the densest village in Nassau County. Many problems, very heavy-duty enforcement. And so I was trained by a private investigator and an architect, basically. And
that's an interesting combo to have in that position.
Well, what is zoning law or building, what is building code? What is zoning law? These laws are created through the police power of the state. And so that's why when somebody receives a violation, for instance, whether it be a nuisance or a construction without permits, these are actual unclassified misdemeanors. So you don't want to have to get to that level if you're under the microscope, bad person, bad neighbor. Those are the last resorts, you know, to take it to that level. I have a lot of background in that. Luckily, in Southampton, it's not on that level. And so we focus in on quality of life enforcement and building code safety issues. That's the gist of it, John.
Right.
Okay.
So, I mean, and safety, what you say, I think that's the main concern. It's like a lot of people think, why do we need a building inspection, and it's really basically, you know, to protect people.
Yes, and also, let's talk about real estate, speaking of protecting people. So how does, how would a building department relate to the real estate industry? Obviously, development of real estate and land, but also maintaining the value of property. Quality of life, maintaining values of property. These are the really what
the
it's all about.
Right,
yeah,
right.
You know, and so laws are created, and if the powers that be want the laws to be enforced, they will be.
Right, and that's what it is. The law is, if you don't like the law, you change it, that's all. Or you find some way to change it.
So the real estate market is really supported by good zoning law and enforcement of zoning law. The commercial aspect is also benefited through public safety and also, you know, good business. And
I mean, well, it's kind of interesting. There was years ago when it was first enacted, the rental permit.
Oh, yeah.
There were people were, like, confused. What do we do about this? Is this necessary? Do you still, with the permit, you still have to go in there, or can somebody else come in and do the inspection?
Well, I don't want to speak for the code enforcement division of the town. Mm-hmm. I'm just speaking for me personally. Let's go back to my prior position as a superintendent of buildings in Manor Haven. That was the second village in Nassau County to initiate the rental law back in early 90s. And it was very controversial. So how that evolved from that time into the Suffolk County villages and towns, it's still evolving. East Hampton recently, there was a story about the rental law and the enforcement thereof. Going back, but the current situation, I'm not going to speak for the code enforcement division and the process.
Well, that makes sense.
But in general, the safety of the tenants is probably the primary focus of any rental law, the health and safety of the tenants.
Right.
So to basically so guard against unscrupulous landlords, absentee landlords.
Right.
Things of that nature.
People that will put in like 15 tenants in a unit that shouldn't have 15 people.
So a certificate of occupancy would be issued, say, 5 years ago for a one-family dwelling with four bedrooms. And the New York State Building Code regulates the occupancy of bedrooms, the number of people, things of that nature. So that relates to quality of life, doesn't it? How many people are in the schools, the tax burden, things of that nature, the densification of neighborhoods, resources being strained. So it kind of ties into both the real estate, the quality of life, and just society in general. So I don't know. Rental law can be a very good thing. It could also be abused. So. Let me ask you, as a real in the real estate business, what's the approach from the real estate perspective?
Well, basically, we tell people to get a rental permit, because if they don't have a rental permit, when it comes to the issue of if there's a tenant-landlord situation dispute, you have no grounds to stand on. So
absolutely.
You have to follow the law. The law is the law.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, every town has to make their own decision and come up with a solution if there is, in fact, a problem. Problems, solutions, and here we are. Do you recall the amount of group rentals that had almost plagued the Southampton?
Oh, yeah. Years ago. It was like through the roof.
So what happened? The community had concerns. Laws were passed. And part of that solution was the real estate, the rental law.
Right. Well, listen, program. I'm going to have you back on the program, again, because there's some other questions I want to ask you. If anybody wants to need some guidance or has a question, how can they go about that?
Well, of course, calling their municipal building department is the best approach. Of course, we're talking about bureaucracies, red tape, and so the town of Southampton actually has a great website with lots of information and pretty easily accessed. So I would suggest that the town residents go to the town website, www.southamptontownny.gov, and check out the website. There's lots of information on the alternative septic systems, the IAOTWS. So that is a burning. Maybe we should get together on that one next time.
Next time?
That's not that I'm an expert on it. But,
okay, but let's talk about that the next time.
Yeah.
All right. Oh, I'm sorry to cut you short, Mark, but this
there is one other thing. The one thing I wanted you to ask me is who's my favorite jazz artist?
I have to ask you the next time. We're going to cut this out. Okay. This is John Christopher for Real Life, and we'll be right back with my next guest, cartoonist Peter Waldner. Welcome back to Real Life, and this is your host, John Christopher. And today I have as my guest, Peter Waldner, who is a fine artist and a political cartoonist. Hi, Peter. How are you today?
Good morning.
No.
Good afternoon.
It's one of those.
Nice to be here.
I know. Coming over from Shelter Island a lot of times, that's you get that time warp, but I understand that perfectly. Speaking of Shelter Island, have you lived on Shelter Island all your life, Peter?
I've been living on the island for 36 years, year-round.
Yeah.
Used to be a summer kid. Grew up in New Jersey.
So how did you get from Jersey to Shelter Island?
Well, we had some neighbors that had a house on the island, and they introduced my parents to the island in, I'm going to say, 63. And we came out, and my folks bought a rundown five-bedroom home for $8,000.
Wow.
And probably
what can you get today? You can't even get a rental for $8,000.
No, it's probably an $800,000 house today. But, it was wonderful. We fixed it up and came out summers growing up. And then in 1980, I met my first wife and ended up staying here.
Oh, so was she from the area?
She grew up on the island.
Oh, yeah. Okay. And did you guys then move to Shelter Island and,
Well, I was looking for a job in the city in commercial art, which wasn't meant to be. And
was it from the political standpoint?
No, really
the
fine
politics
art.
Okay.
Painting and drawing and illustrating. I really had no thoughts of being a cartoonist, even though I did it all my life. But a friend of mine's parents asked if I wanted to paint their house, and I said sure, and I stayed 36 years.
Wow. When did you first realize that you had an artistic bent or talent there?
Well, I've been drawing all my life since I can remember.
Really? So as a small child, you were...
Oh, yeah. We were always drawing and painting. I still have my first painting I'd given to my dad when I was 9. And he died a couple of years ago, and I have it back now. It's of a church steeple. But, no, I've done artwork all my life and, did cartoons in high school and college and caricatures. And my wife and I had an art gallery in Shelter Island for 5 years as well, up until the recession hit.
Okay.
We had to close.
Well, stuff happens.
Yeah.
Were your folks, like a lot of parents, where whatever you drew, they said, oh, that's magnificent, that's fantastic?
That's a good question. I suppose so.
But, but a lot of kids, they don't go on to art, but you did. You continued.
Well, oddly enough, my parents had a friend who was a cartoonist and an artist, and she discouraged my going to art school. I actually was a jock growing up, and I played basketball and football in high school and college. And so I had that interest as well. And I didn't really want to go to an art school and just sort of live and breathe art. I went to a liberal arts school. I majored in art. So that was just one interest.
So wait a second. So you didn't go to art school, but you did go to an art school. Is that
what
you're
saying?
Well,
I majored in art.
Okay.
A liberal arts school.
Okay.
But it wasn't just about art. It's what my major. I minored in filmmaking, and that was actually more of a passion. And I didn't really even think about doing cartoons until I started doing them for the paper on Shelter Island.
And that got you started.
Yeah, the truth is I saw a really bad cartoon in the paper one day, and I thought, well, I could do better than that. And so I did a cartoon, and I brought it into the editor, and she ran it. And I've had a cartoon on their desk every Monday morning for 23 years now.
Well, that leads me to the next question is that, do you ever have times, since you're doing, this is a weekly thing that you do, do you mm-hmm. ever have times where you look at the page and you say, what the heck am I going to come up with?
I don't really anymore. I did a syndicated cartoon for 12 years, which was a daily. So I was doing 35 a month, 8 a week. That was hard because I was...
8 a week. So you had to have 8 ideas, basically.
Yeah, but we used to work 3 months ahead of time for the syndicated cartoon. So now I would be doing, 4th of July cartoons. You always had to have a stockpile ahead of time. So it was very hard to do.
What's the rationale for that?
I think they just wanted to have a backup in case something went wrong or in case you didn't meet your deadline, which I always did.
Mm-hmm.
But that was much harder to come up with fresh ideas. So in other words, you'd send in a month's worth every month and always be ahead. So at Christmas, I'm thinking, St. Patrick's, and, in the summer, I'm thinking ahead to the fall, which makes it much harder to come up with ideas because you can't, like the editorial cartoons, you can't do anything topical because you don't know what will be happening in 3 months. Yeah. You can do holidays and things like that, but you can't do what's going on in sports and entertainment and politics and that sort of thing.
You must be having fun with the politics now.
I have to pull back on it a little bit because I've done so many Trump cartoons that they'd ask me to sort of tone it down.
So now you have to come out with Hillary cartoons?
Well, I could do 3 a day with just Trump, honestly.
Wow. Well, there's a lot of fodder there, isn't there?
Well, it's in the news every day. But I just submitted one this morning, which was just a springtime Easter. People want to laugh, and that's really my main goal.
Right.
And when you do politics, you know going in you're going to get about half the people mad at you, no matter what you do.
Now, that's a question I have. Is it hazardous to, do political commentary? Do you ever get, people saying, Peter, what the heck were you thinking?
Oh, yes. when I did the syndicated cartoon, I got a lot of letters from around the country and actually from other countries, oddly enough. And most of them were wonderful, but occasionally they were kind of crazy, and some were very angry. And it's always the political ones that get people angry. So there have been some letters to the editor on Shelter Island. There was a very infamous one about 5 years ago, very, very nasty letter that opened up a whole can of worms because it asked the question, well, let's put it this way. Woman, it was sort of a personal attack on me because she didn't like my cartoon. And the following week, there were 16 letters in the paper, 2 full pages, sort of attacking her. And that opened the subject of whether a newspaper should print a letter that is personal. In other words, she could have said, I don't like your cartoons, I don't like your politics. But she said some really nasty things, and that upset people.
Ooh.
So it opened up a debate that went on for a very long time, actually. So I have gotten some very nasty letters.
Wow. Now, let me ask you a question. Now, I love your characters. Now, have they evolved like the original Mickey Mouse evolved, as compared to the Mickey Mouse that we see today? I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. It's like the original Mickey Mouse that Disney came about doesn't look anything like Mickey
right.
today. Have your characters evolved like that?
I think they have. I think they've become maybe a little less grotesque. I think people relate to my cartoons because I see them as us.
Right.
They're bald heads and pot bellies and big ears. And they're really sort of everyday people. And I think that's what people relate to. When I look back on my early ones, I think the noses and the ears, and everything was a little bigger, a little more exaggerated. So it has evolved somewhat.
Yeah, that's fabulous. Peter, how could someone get in touch with you if they wanted to? Because I know you also do great art, fine art. Is there, do you have a website or anything?
We do have a website, Wishrock Studio.
Okay.
Is the name. My wife still has a frame shop, which she did in our gallery when we had the gallery, so we kept the name. But the website is wishrockstudio.com.
Fantastic. Yes. Peter Waldner,
cartoonist. It's been great having you on the program, and this is John Christopher, and we'll be right back with our next guest, Dr. Lawrence Bono, neuro-ophthalmologist. Welcome back to Real Life, and this is John Christopher, and today as my guest, I have the wonderful Dr. Lawrence Bono, who is a neuro-ophthalmologist for the North Shore Eye Care. Hi, Lawrence. How are you today?
I'm doing well.
Good. We're very fortunate to have a guy like you of your caliber here on the East End. So tell me, what is a neuro-ophthalmologist? Why is that different than a regular ophthalmologist?
Yeah, John, thanks for saying that. Neuro-ophthalmology, it's a subspecialty of ophthalmology that really deals with the visual problems that are related to the central nervous system. I see a variety of conditions that affect the vision, including brain tumors, stroke, inflammatory conditions, multiple sclerosis, and cranial neuropathies.
Just so MS affects vision?
Yeah, absolutely.
I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, it sure can.
And in what sense? Because of it's a brain related?
Well, multiple sclerosis is a disorder in which the myelin, which is the protective sheath around the nerve itself, is disrupted, and that actually short circuits the neural transmission.
Now, you know, it's kind of interesting. I'm just going to digress for 1 second here. I'm sure I'm going to have people ask me, why would I have a neuro-ophthalmologist on Real Life, which is about real estate, and what's the correlation? And I just want to update people that years ago when I was first starting, which is about 20 years ago, I had a listing with an older couple, and I asked them, why are you guys moving? And they said, well, because of the medical profession out here, there's hardly any. And now we're very fortunate to have somebody like of your caliber here. And now the medicine that we have out here is pretty good. So one of the things is that I want to ask you is you reside in Quogue, correct?
I do, yeah.
Yeah. So of all the places to pick, why did you pick Quogue?
When we first moved to the East End, my wife, Christine, and I were living in West Hampton Beach. And after a while, we got to know the area, and we decided we really liked East Quogue. It had a lot of things we were looking for, including proximity to our three office locations. And the schools were great for our children. We have two sons, James and Christopher. And we just really like the community. So we've been there since 2006, and we love it.
It's a great community. I understand there's the village is not much, but there's somewhat of a community feel there, correct?
Yeah.
So let's ask a question about eyes. Remember that thing to do with the black and blue dress that was on the internet? And supposedly women saw the dress as black and blue, and men saw it as white and gold. Why do you think there's such a difference there?
Yeah, I did. I did recall seeing this thing on the internet. So this is really a phenomenon of the blue dress that illustrates an optical illusion. It's created by the way the dress was photographed. Our perception of color is affected.
But women, they see it as white and gold and guys?
Well, it didn't seem to, you know, really separate along gender lines. There were, you know, females who saw it as a white and gold as well. And it's really just an illusion of the way that the picture was photographed. So our brain will perceive colors in a different way depending on what adjacent colors are and what the illumination of the photograph is. So in this example of the blue dress, the color of the background and the brain's perception of the ambient light really affected the way that some people saw the color of the dress. So if the brain perceives that the lighting is dim in the photograph, it will try to adjust for that and subtract that dimness. And so in this example, it'll subtract the blue hue and will have that person perceive that the blue is actually white but shadowed. And so it kind of subtracts that, and then it alters the way that you perceive the color.
So is the brain making this happen?
Yeah, the brain's making this happen.
One of the things that you specialize in is also cataract surgery. And we were talking earlier about that. It goes back to the Egyptians, I think, and they were doing some form of cataract surgery. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, the ancient Egyptians performed a type of cataract surgery called couching. And it's a technique that's thought to originate back in India in 800 BC. The technique essentially uses a long, slender needle, and the needle is passed about 3 millimeters behind the cornea into the lens itself, and the lens is dislocated into the vitreous cavity, and it the lens resides in that part of the eye, and if the patient is lucky enough to avoid the myriad of complications, they actually saw better, and it worked pretty well.
And the Romans also did something like that, right?
Yeah, they did. The Romans actually improved the technique slightly. They developed this really remarkable tool that was hollowed. It had a hollow core and was essentially like a straw. And then they had a second instrument that fit perfectly into the first and would slide into the second instrument. So they inserted this needle, the first needle-like instrument, again, in the same place, about 3 millimeters behind the cornea. And then they would insert the second needle through the hollow core and would use suction to remove the lens. The surgeon would actually suck on the straw itself and remove the lens material. And this, you know, worked apparently pretty well. I mean, guess that the patients who had this procedure actually did a lot better than the patients who had the prior couching procedure. So, but what's really so fascinating about this is essentially what we do today in modern cataract surgery. We're actually using a small tip needle and we're extracting the lens material through suction. Of course, I don't use my mouth. I use a
I use a
phaecal emulsifier.
I would hope so.
Essentially the same thing.
Well, let me ask you a question. How did that back then, did they have some sort of numbing for the eyeball or no? It was just
I think they had Jack Daniels.
Or some wine, right?
Yeah.
Here, drink this keg here and you'll be fine and your eyeball won't move.
No, I don't think they used much anesthetic at that time.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Well, I'm glad we're in this century as compared to that century. One of the things that I find fascinating is that you majored in philosophy while as an undergrad. Were you thinking of going into philosophy and what attracted you to it?
Yeah, I did major in philosophy, but I always intended to go to medical school.
Why and, philosophy? Would you have that as a...
Well, I had a friend and a mentor physician kind of told me to explore my options in undergraduate and to kind of think outside the box and maybe try some different classes. And he suggested philosophy. And when I, you know, took my first class, I really fell in love with the topic and thought this was something I wanted to learn more about. As it turns out, I find really no practical application for a philosophy major.
Right.
But it's something I think I use every day. It really teaches you how to think and how to analyze problems.
See, I wouldn't think that. I would think I would go to you if you were sitting on top of the mountain and say, what is the meaning of life, doctor? But I haven't asked you that yet. So anyway, something else that's been developing is now they have what they call bionic eyes. Do you think it'll become, you know, bionic surgery will be commonplace like cataract surgery at some point?
Yeah, I do. I think that at some point this could become a reality and be very common. I mean, the concept of interfacing biologics with machines has always really intrigued us. And it's, you know, served as the basis for many science fiction stories. But what you don't realize is that we really already have a working bionic eye, a camera.
You mean... Oh.
The camera is a bionic eye. It essentially does mechanically what your eye does.
Right.
And so originally cameras captured the image through a chemical process and stored it on cellulose or film. More modern cameras do the same thing, but they store the image in a digital format. So a bionic eye would really just simply be a camera in the shape of an eye and would have a storage format which really hasn't been discovered yet. We need that way to communicate that information through the optic nerve to the brain, and we don't quite understand what that format is. But I think as soon as we understand that format, then the bionic eye will be a reality.
Is there a website that people can go and learn about you?
We do. We have a website, North Shore Eye Care. The website is nseye.com.
Great. Lawrence, been a delight having you on the program.
This is John Christopher for Real Life on Peconic Public Broadcasting, 88.3, right here in Southampton, New York. By the way, if you're interested in hearing this program again or previous ones, you can go to peconicpublicbroadcasting.org and subscribe to the podcast. Until next time, looking forward to seeing you soon and have a safe journey.
You've been listening to Real Life, the program that talks to the people about the places and things that are the pulse and heartbeat of real estate on the East End. Your host has been John Christopher, associate broker with Sotheby's International Realty. Your producer and engineer is Kyle Lynch. Theme music by John Christopher. Questions and comments can be emailed to john.christopher@sotheby'shomes.com.